Hello, my name is Robert Morrissey. I'm from the Artful Project at the University of Chicago, and I've been working with Jean Gabriel and some of my colleagues here on the question of use and reuse in the 18th century, the survival of the Enlightenment in the 19th century. And we started working on this a long time ago in 2000, around 2007. We had brought up an edition of the Encyclopédie, and we began thinking about source of the Encyclopédie, and we began looking at ways of trying to find these sources in a larger corpus that we have, which is called Fontexte, which has about 3,000 works in it. And at the same time, we were looking forward to the kind of heritage of the Enlightenment in the 19th century. So as we began working on this, we got to the size of corpora that I mentioned, at 3,000 to 5,000, and we began thinking of trying to scale up significantly. And our first attempt at this was in 2013, when we had a grant from the NEH which was called Digging Into Data. And what we did was we took the entire 18th century collections online attempted, that has about 200,000 texts in it, and attempted to look at use and reuse over time. And then at that time, OBVIA was being formed, and we came into contact with Jean Gabriel, and who had done significant work in this area with a program called Phoebus and a more micro text editing system called Medit. And so we, as we began working on this, we started to do different techniques. And one of the most interesting techniques turned out to be sequence alignment. And so we began looking at when text is reused over a large corpus. So if we actually, as we came out of this, and so at the same time that this was being brought up in Paris, Abbeville turned to the French National Library, and they put together a corpus of some 130,000 texts. So it's a very large corpus of French textual materials, drawn essentially from the Gallica collection, which many of you know. And so one of the things that has come out of this collaboration is actually the establishment of this enormous, what's called la très grande base. So we've moved from about 200,000 works in English to about 130,000 in French. And it gives us a chance to think about phenomena in terms of cultural systems and not just on smaller databases. And the second thing to come out of this was a highly optimized sequence alignments program, which Clovis will talk about. So Glenn, this is my colleague Glenn Rowe, who is at the Sorbonne. And we have this set of software that works very well and is designed to work across languages. So we've used it on Chinese, on Japanese, as well as on various European languages. And the third thing is an actual database of sequences, passages that are reused over in the 19th century. So if you just looked at and so as we tried to think about the Enlightenment inheritance, we wanted to get a corpus that we felt was that we could run a control experiment on. And so we chose as a first pass, and then we went and did it on larger corpora, but we chose the Encyclopédie. And so we began saying, when is the Encyclopédie reused in the 19th century? The idea is being able to see what its impact was. Now, it turns out we had actually run this experience once before on our Frontex database. So that's about 3,000 works, about, let's say, 1,200 in the 19th century. And if you actually tried to look at what sequences in the Encyclopédie are used in the 19th century in Frontex, almost none. So the idea was that our first idea in coming into this was that there was little inheritance, and so we began, when we got this very large database, we began looking at this, and lo and behold, as you'll be looking at some of the software that we developed here. So you see the Encyclopédie on one side and the TGB, La Très Grande Base, on the other side. And if you just do run a search, so we're trying to do this live, Lord knows what the perils of this are going to be, but you get about 117,000 passages that are that you find in the TGB and in the Encyclopédie. And in this, of course, there's a lot of junk. If you just look at the first passage, for example, there's it's just a title. So you get a lot of things like just repetition of the Encyclopédie, etc. And so the idea is then when you're dealing with large corpora like this is how to filter it down to reduce the scale of what you're dealing with. And one of the first things we did was to develop a only relatively successful banality filter, just eliminating things like sequences of numbers and things like this. And then you can just also just limit the number of the minimum number of words in a line. So you're not. So we've chosen for this 15 words. You can do, you can fix 10 words. You can do 2 words. But the fewer the words, the greater the kind of distortions you find, or the less impactful passages you find. And so and the nice thing is if we were able to make use of the Encyclopédie's metadata. So the Encyclopédie, as you know, is there's a set of classifications, and we were able to make use of those as we tried to make sense of these passages. So we're going to start out here by browsing the passages by classification. So you can see that you have jurisprudence, which is an enormous category. So these are all categories of knowledge in the Encyclopédie established by the encyclopédiste. And you'll notice there's a large segment of unclassified works, the very first, and that's because, in fact, in the Encyclopédie, they remained unclassified. So there were about 13,000 of these that remained, and so we developed, using machine learning techniques, a method of actually reclassifying these articles. And so we took all the articles in the Encyclopédie, we had the algorithms train on each subject to establish a model, and then using the actual classification indicated in the article, and then we went back and hid the classification as indicated to see how successful the model was in identifying the each subject. So we ended up with about 74% accuracy. The big takeaway is it allowed us to classify all the articles. And then when we looked at those that were not classified in the same way by the algorithms as by the encyclopédistes, there often was, it became a kind of heuristic advice, device for exploring what was the cause of this difference. So right now we're going to, you can see that when you move from the classifications that were originally given, the belles lettres is quite highly represented, whereas it more or less disappears when you go into the machine classification. Nevertheless, jurisprudence remains, most of the categories remain quite similar in the classes. That said, we're going to be talking a lot about, because we all work in belles lettres and poésie, we'll be talking about that here. And so if we go in now and we start looking at the, right, so it's not. So we're now actually trying to, right. So we've chosen belles lettres as the category, and you can see that the first example that comes up, so on the right here, you've got we're looking at the actual passages that are most frequent down the right-hand side here. And so the first quotation is Mal qui répand la terreur, mal qui que le ciel en sa fureur. So obviously this is not from an encyclopedist at all, it's from La Fontaine. And the second most frequent passage is not from an encyclopedist, it's from Racine. So you said one of the first things you see is the encyclopedia is just, these are quotations of classical literature, French literature in the encyclopedia, and you can see how much the encyclopedia is just a hub for recycling much of the most well-known literature. Interestingly enough, just I can just say in passing that the Racine passages from Esther, which is one of his Catholic plays, which we'll see this question of Catholicity will be coming back over and over again as we talk here. So, and this kind of thing, phenomenon we're seeing here is the same reason why jurisprudence dominates so much, because there's a corpus of jurisprudence in the encyclopedia that is just transmitted through into the literature of the 19th century, not necessarily through the encyclopedia, but it's part of this general culture that moves forward. So, Glenn, would you like to?
Where
was
that?
D'Alembert.
The next
thing? Oh yeah, so we were gonna look at D'Alembert, right? All right, we have a French keyboard, English keyboard problem here. So if we, go ahead, you want to talk?
Yeah, so the idea on this is that this was a problem we encountered also in the ECHO project, is that you just got a sort of critical mass of shared passages which didn't really have any relationship through the, there was no way of saying that these passages came through the encyclopedia, they were just shared to the general culture. So if we really wanted to think about traces of the encyclopedia or influences or how it is picked up, actually in the 19th century we thought, well, you should start with the sort of main texts that are always cited and that are the famous articles. And so there's a famous D'Alembert's introduction, which is the Discours Préliminaire, which is this, it lays out the whole structure of the encyclopedia, it lays out its philosophical project, what it aims to do. We thought, well, we should be able to find sort of fairly strong resonances of that in the 19th century. But in fact, we only find about 167 results, 167 reuses. And what's interesting here, if we look at the titles of where these occur, is that it's very much used as a manual for making other dictionaries. So that's it's a way of ruminating on how do you put together other dictionaries, how is dictionary making in and of itself a text. And so 14 of these passages come from a work none of us knew at the beginning of the century from Peignot, the Dictionnaire raisonné de bibliologie, so a reasoned dictionary of bibliology, which was a fledgling field that apparently didn't take off, but it's sort of a prototypical book history. And in it, he uses these passages from D'Alembert to try to think about how he's putting together the structure of this new science of bibliology and also this reasoned dictionary of bibliography. And for us, so you can just sort of see how this works. You keep winnowing down using different facets and different filters until you get to a passage that's fairly interesting and salient. And then for us, it's always very important, and we'll see if this works, to be able to, to always get back to the text itself, to passages within the text in their specific instances. And in this case, it pushes to a philologic search where you see the passage highlighted. And you can also see the sort of state of the OCR that comes from the Gallica project. And so to sort of obviate this, the risk that the OCR might be giving bad results, we also now have links directly into the page images from Gallica. So you can begin to see, and this is really important in these unstructured large databases where things like notes don't have any structure, or so, you know, if a passage is in a note, that's a significant intellectual thing, whether if it's not a note, but you can't really tell from just the plain text of the database.
So this is a whole new way of exploring the Gallica corpus. For the first time, it allows you to go into it from a very different angle. And the idea is that you can always get back to the text, which is something that we firmly believe in is absolutely important.
Right. So, I mean, here clearly he's using D'Alembert. It's hard to say, but it's another spelling of D'Alembert's name. It's a different thing. It's not sure that a sort of typical citation mining would pick this up, especially with the OCR. But in this case, we're able to sort of telescope into this text and see exactly where he's using it. How do I get out of it?
Question.
It's in full screen.
Where are we? It closed everything.
What?
I need to close everything.
That's why you don't do live.
That's why we don't do live.
There you go.
Okay.
So we could also look at other famous articles. So we wanted to look at the equally famous article Encyclopédie by Diderot, which was itself a reply, a sort of a corrective of the Discours Préliminaire, and in that case, and these are texts that I'm teaching the Encyclopédie now, and of course, and it's interesting to say that there's always a set of articles that we, or the historiography of the work, put out there to teach to students, and they get repeated over and over, and these are the most important articles, and Encyclopédie is always important. But if you look at how they're used actually in the 19th century in this database, it's very scant. So there's only 20 results. There should be only 20, so I don't know why. 15.
Oh, because you didn't limit the length.
Oh, right. No. So only...
No.
It's a terrible keyboard. I don't know what happened. but we can see that there's only 20 passages of this really seminal article on the Encyclopédie, where Diderot sort of lays out his plan, his sort of counter-argument to D'Alembert, where he lays out his whole system of cross-references, which is really important for us as historians of the Encyclopédie, but it's hardly dwelled upon. And in fact, there's only 20 things. And again, it's used in this realm of dictionary making, of ways to think about how do you make a dictionary. So that someone's writing a dictionary of the army, they take that Diderot's text, they use it, and they say, this is how Diderot put his text together. This is what you put in a dictionary. This is what you don't put in a dictionary. These are the fears that Diderot sort of encountered, and we find that this is one of the most popular passages where Diderot himself says, you can't constrain knowledge in the way that we want to, and in fact, every time you try to, it sort of bursts out in different places, and it becomes what he calls this monster of de l'art poétique, as he calls it. And so people take this back up as a way of sort of the challenge of dictionary making, the challenge of constraining information, which is almost always too much. And then we sort of see where... on est où? Ah oui, c'est là, dans les titres. And then you can see where the Encyclopédie moves to a certain, moves out of the dictionary realm and perhaps into a different reactionary phase. And in this case, this happens to be a novel from the 18th century that was published in the late 1770s, Le Comte de Valmont, ou Les Égarements de la Raison. It's the story of a nobleman who starts out as a materialist and an atheist and ends up coming back to his faith of Catholicism. And so it's one of these stories. And it has some presence in the 18th century, but it actually shows back up. It becomes wildly popular in the early 19th century, so in the years of the Restoration. So it's republished, it's re-edited all over. And so this is where we get to this resonance of this use of Diderot. And it's the same passage about the monstrosity of the Encyclopédie, but in fact he uses it against Diderot in this case. And it says, you know, the Encyclopédists himself knew that they had a poison pill, that they had something that was already monstrous that they were peddling to people, and you do better off just ignoring that. So it becomes a criticism of the Enlightenment itself rather than just simply Diderot. You know, these are the sorts of things that you can have a focused exploration from one article, but what was really interesting is that the articles that we're all used to citing and circulating weren't the ones that were the most widely disseminated in this database.
So the one thing that we were able to take away at this point is that the structure of the Encyclopédie became a source of constant reference over the 19th century in building encyclopedias and dictionaries.
We talk about authors.
Right.
So another way to think about limiting these search was if we thought about, if we take the sort of big three authors. So we've talked about Diderot. If we take Voltaire and Rousseau and see how they work, and then we're going to add D'Holbach for other reasons, just to sort of see how their articles within the encyclopedia might reach out into the 19th century. If we look at Voltaire, Voltaire is an interesting case because he wanted to write more for the encyclopedia, he wanted to write more of the philosophical articles, but Diderot denied him this. So Diderot said, no, just do belles lettres, do history. So he only writes about 40 articles, which are by and large a testament to his great culture, literary culture. And in fact, that's what we find in the sequences. So Voltaire himself becomes a sort of literary hub that's just trafficking in these classical citations from the past through the encyclopedia, in this case, through Voltaire.
So we also look at Rousseau, who distinguished himself by not wanting to be a hub, by wanting to express himself in an original way. And as some of you may know, he was his task in the encyclopedia was to handle the field of music. And so, if you look at when articles by Rousseau in the Encyclopédie are cited in the TGB in the 19th century, there are about 611 citations, and most of them are related to music. So they're actually looking at the Encyclopédie as a source of information. He only wrote one article that was not about music, and that was called Économie, in which he placed the kernel of his contrat social, his social contract. And so of the 611 citations, 122 are drawn from the Économie, this very subversive text. So in this case, we can see that that there is a significant ideological impact, and that if you actually look at the titles, so then you use another, go down the facets and say what titles are used, and you'll see that you're no longer. So where are we here? If you look at the titles, we're no longer in simply the world of dictionaries and reference works, but much more what we would call substantive titles, where this is really being made use of in a very ideological manner. And I thought we might just close looking at one more, and this would be the D'Holbach. So D'Holbach was a radical materialist. And so linked to this kind of vision of the encyclopedia as a free-thinking materialist enterprise, and yet...
Yeah, and yet, I mean, he's an interesting case because he probably has the strongest reputation as this atheist freethinker. And if you read people like Jonathan Israel, the encyclopedia becomes this sort of machine de guerre materialiste, which maybe it is, maybe it isn't, but it's through people like D'Holbach. But if you look at D'Holbach's contributions to the encyclopedia, he certainly contributed some of the more controversial articles. There's one on représentants, there's one on prêtres that's really ferociously anti-clerical. But he also wrote lots of articles on mineralogy, the majority of articles on mineralogy, on chemistry, on jurisprudence, history of the Holy Roman Empire. And it's these articles, in fact, that survive into the 19th century. And actually, we were surprised because you thought it would be these sort of really controversial materialist articles that show up in the 19th century, but that's it's not actually the case. And so one would assume that you'd find the article Prêtre, as I said, which was this really ferociously anti-clerical work, but we find instead the most cited used article of D'Holbach is Évêque, and it's just used as a sort of history of the elector bishops in the Holy Roman Empire. So it's a way of testifying, and lots of his other works are used for practical reasons, how to mix paint, how to make bleu, azure bleu, as the color. So he continues on into the 19th century in a way that really contemporary historiography doesn't pick up on. Nobody sort of talks about D'Holbach as this man of science who sort of continues throughout the 19th century to be cited and used and reused in an interesting way. So it begins to give us a different perspective and a different view on preconceived ideas of literary history.
So what's kind of interesting is if you took the canonical database of Frontex, which has all the canonical works of French literature, the encyclopedia disappears. When you move out to this much larger database, you're able to see how it works, and you're able to see how it works on several different levels, on the level of structure, on the level of ideology, and on the level of just sheer information. And so that's really the kinds of things you can begin to explore with these big databases, kind of how a work, how this fits into a whole cultural system in some sense. So this was just, we wanted to begin with some concrete examples that we were able to see in working with this. And Clovis, my colleague Clovis Gladstone, is just going to talk about the actual software that allows us to find these passages.
So as Robert mentioned earlier, one of the goals in when we wrote the software to detect the reuses is we wanted to have something that worked at scale. We had previously built a software called Philolene that actually ran fine on moderately big corpora, but we found that when we ran it on 100,000 texts or more, it could take several weeks to detect the reuses. So we wanted to have something that could run in several hours so that we could actually change the parameters of the matches so that if we didn't like the alignments, if they were giving us too many false matches, we could restrain the parameters and run the experiment again. And so that was the first important thing. We wanted to be able to run the software at any scale. Now the other question was, which is something that we've been asking ourselves for quite a while, is what is intertextuality? And what are we looking to detect? So we know that relationships between texts are complicated, they're multifaceted, and a key element of humanistic understanding is tracing links between texts at all levels, from direct attributed quotations to influences and allusions. And in our case, we were really interested in finding actually quotations, clear text reuses. And so that determined our choice in the computational approach that we used. We could have used something like a vector space similarity, but unfortunately vector space similarity does not really allow you to find direct quotations or text reuses within running text. So this is why we decided to use something that we call, that's called sequence alignment. So sequence alignment is a generalized technique to identify regions of similarity shared by two strings of text in text, in running text. It's basically the longest common substring problem. So there's it's used in many different domains, such as bioinformatics to detect similar DNA sequences, or for plagiarism detection, for instance. So the advantages of sequence alignment is that it respects the order of the text in the document. It doesn't use a bag of words model such as in a vector space techniques. It does not require the pre-identification of blocks for comparison. It doesn't need to know that, it doesn't need to compare one chapter to another chapter. It compares the entire text to another document. It is, and its core functions are language independent. It can run in basically any language. And it's also able to take into account various variations due to insertions, deletions, orthographic variations, OCR errors, and I'll show you some examples of that later. This new piece of software is called TextAlign. And so it inherits its basic algorithm from Philolene. The algorithm that it uses, which I will go into very, very brief detail, was chosen basically because of its lack of computational complexity. It is designed really to be fast. The model it uses is based on a shingles of n-grams representation of documents. And so I'm sure many of you are familiar with n-grams, but I'm just going to go briefly into it. So n-grams are blocks of n number of words, which are usually constructed after various pre-processing steps. And so these n-grams, in our case, are generated leaving some overlap from one to the other. So you can see this passage here by Shakespeare, and you can see at the bottom how the n-grams are constructed. And so in this case, these are trigrams, groups of three tokens. And you can see how it basically builds these n-grams. And there's a one-word overlap between each n-gram. And so each text is basically converted to this representation. So when we create these n-grams, there are various parameters, such as the size of the n-grams. We have various filtering options, such as removing function words, removing numbers. We also normalize the text. We try to remove as many variants of any word. So we can remove accents, for instance, for French. We can stem, we can lemmatize. We also try to modernize the language so that we can directly compare 18th century French to 19th century French. We have a number of tokenization rules that we can apply, and depending on the language, you may have very different tokenization rules, say for Chinese, than you would for French. You can also allow various gaps within the n-gram. You can jump over a word or not when you construct your n-grams, and you can also determine whether you want your n-grams to be in order, because some languages are not bound by any particular word order. Once again, Chinese, Japanese, not necessarily as much as Western languages. And so once you've selected your parameters for the n-gram generation phase, you also want to set your parameters for the actual matching phase. And so basically you're going to determine how many n-grams do I have in a passage, how many common n-grams between two passages do you need to constitute a match? And our default is 4, but you could decide it's 3 or 2. And then you're going to decide on various other things, such as the gap between matching n-grams. How big of a gap can I have between two matching n-grams in a passage? Should my gap be flexible? Should my gap increase if the passage I'm matching is getting bigger and bigger? Can I merge passages if they're in close vicinity in both documents? And so once you've set all those parameters, you run your alignment. It can take a while if you have a big corpus. And so basically the way it works is that you have your two documents. It tries to see if you have any common n-grams between two documents. It turns out that common n-grams are relatively rare. So when you do find some, you start your match at the beginning of each n-gram in both documents, and then you start looking forward. And you try to see if you have any matching n-grams within a certain window. And if you say you don't have 4 matching n-grams within a 20 n-gram window, for instance, well, you say, well, this is not a match. There's not enough common text. If you do, then you say, okay, I have 4 matching n-grams within my 20 n-gram window. I open a new window and I continue looking forward. And you continue on and on until you find the end of your match, and then you actually store it. So I'm just going to give you some quick examples of the kind of alignments it's able to do. So in this instance, you have a passage by Rousseau and another that's actually in the TGB. And you can see how it's able to match with some moderate additions. So what you see in red is the common text. But it's also able to match, to find common passages with more significant additions. And that's playing around with that gap parameter. And you can see how, in this instance, Jean-Baptiste Auguste Bertrand is citing Rousseau, and you can see he cites an initial part of the quote, then inserts a comment, and then finishes his citation. And of course, in the TGB, we had although the OCR was of very good quality, there are some texts which weren't of great quality. And so we were still nevertheless able to match some of these passages despite the quality of the OCR. So after you run the alignment, we store them. So they're stored on disk. We then load them into a database to make it searchable. And we build a web application with various predefined parameters, such as which fields you want to make available for searching. So you saw a little bit what Glenn and Robert showed you, what the web application can do. You can search across all the alignments. You can filter. You can highlight also the differences between two passages. You also have a timeline of when a set of reuses are used across time. So you could look at, for instance, when is Rousseau or when is Voltaire reused in the 19th century, if there are spikes at any moment in time. And it turns out we found that there are spikes used mostly when they're important dictionaries, which cite a lot of the classical sources. So you'll see those spikes at these different dates. And so what we also did, so when we built this system, we wanted to make sure that it would work not only for this particular project, so it's not tailored to this exact project, even though it was built with this project in mind. We wanted to work on other corpora. And so we ran various experiments, such as on an Italian corpus. And in this instance, although you can't see really the text, but here this is a search of Dante in a medieval Italian text. So you're getting all the occurrences of Dante, of reuses of Dante in these Italian texts. We also ran it on a set of French revolutionary pamphlets that we have and that we provided by the Newberry Library. And in this case, we're looking for reuses of the social contract in the French Revolutionary pamphlets. And so, as Robert mentioned, we've run it also on Chinese and Japanese. I don't have examples here because I wouldn't know what to type anyways. But we do work with Chinese and Japanese scholars, so we've been able to leverage their help in these instances. And so we're actually not done with this work on building this tool. We'd like to extend it further. And we'd like to extend it in a way where we're not trying to find literal matches, but more distant matches. Basically based on maybe topic similarity, maybe even allusions. We have a very specific example in mind. We know that Robespierre, a famous figure of the French Revolution, was heavily influenced by Rousseau's political thought. But when you actually run an alignment of all of Robespierre's works, all of Rousseau's works against Robespierre's works, you find very, very few reuses of Rousseau. So the idea is that basically Robespierre digested Rousseau's works so well that he's able to then write about various political issues and basically read just like Rousseau, which is in fact the case of this particular passage. It basically clearly references Rousseau's general will, even though he's rewritten in it, Robespierre's rewritten it in his own way. And so how can we detect that that particular Robespierre's passage is clearly influenced by Rousseau's thought? This is basically our next step. How can we detect these kinds of more distant similarities, which are very important if you're trying to track intellectual influence across time. Thank you. And now I'm going to...
Jean-Gabriel is going to talk about his experiments with visualizing these kinds of results to give us a different perspective on reuses.
So just I would like to remind that what Robert said in his introduction is that we were working in parallel on the same problem. So they were working on a sequence alignment to detect similarities and to detect reuses. And I was working in parallel, because I didn't know them at this time, on the Phoebus project, which means hypertext. Oh, it's in French, it's an acronym. It's a hypertext of Balzac. Projet d'hypertexte de l'œuvre de Balzac utilisant des similarités. And so this was exactly the same problem. And we use a very similar techniques, which were engram, which are called fingerprint. In fact, this technique are they come from plagiarism detection technique, but we need to add some, as mentioned before, Clovis. We need to add some parameter to allow holes, to allow, for instance, systematization or the different or gap between these different things. So this is what we were doing in parallel, and with this project we wanted to merge our different techniques to have a more general software, and this is exactly what we did and what Clovis described before. But there was a problem, and this is a problem I want to show you here. The problem is that if we are dealing with huge databases of text, big corpus, which is exactly what we wanted to do. The number of your users is tremendous. It's you imagine here, you have on Frontex and TGB, we have 8,074, nearly 900,000 reusers, which is very difficult to detect. Even I just want to precise that these reusers are not the engram. We agglomerate engram, and when we mention 874,000, it means 874,000 texts which are reused, which is very, very difficult to, it's impossible. Especially, so with the encyclopedia we have less, 300,000, but it's a lot. How can you manage with this? And with the corpus, they obtain 70 million of reusers. And most of these reusers are completely uninteresting. Many are maybe very interesting for people. There are a lot of quotation of the Bible, but it's very difficult because let's suppose you have, for instance, 1,000 quotation of the Bible, the same passage. The problem is that you have 1 million of reusers, which is very difficult. And so this is exactly what we want to do. It is to cluster these reusers, to make it more understandable. To see, okay, these reusers, you have a lot of reusers, but this corresponds to the same part of the text. And this is what we are doing. We want to have a syntactic view of these reusers. So, how did we manage to do this? And this is what I wanted to do, is to use graph theory. Why to use graph theory? Because reusers, in a way, act like agents on graphs. So this is what we are doing. So just I would like to recall, but maybe most of you know, so I will go very fastly, but I don't know, because when we are working with humanists, some of them don't know what is a graph, and especially in the Sorbonne, not you, but the other, when you say graph, they think it's just a drawing. I say, no, graph is a mathematical object, so just... Just before you had this in mind. I had to explain to Robert before. So, what is a graph? A graph is a mathematical object which consists in set of entities and relation between entities. And you can draw this on a picture. Here are graphs. And you have a lot of graphs. You have very small graph, but also you have huge graph. And in a way, the web is a graph, and you can represent the web with a graph. And for instance, in my lab, there are people working on very big graph which correspond to the web. And so the question is, what are the entities, which are called nodes, and what are the links between those nodes? And this corresponds to reusers. So I will give you an example. Here, it's a small piece of text. And this text is in relation with another piece of text. They are very closely related. You see, this is the same text. You have just a word which differs. So we may have a lot of difference and something like that. But we have some relation. It is possible to detect them with the engram detection technique, or maybe with other technique, and in the future we'd like to detect this with other things. I will not go in depth or in detail on this. So, what are the advantages to use graph? Because we are able to manage very big graph, and you have a lot of techniques which are very interesting, and the mathematical community develop a lot of concept with graph. And here, we shall use two concepts which are very interesting, which is the concept of communities, and it corresponds to the web. When you have, so you study the web, you have people who are in contact each other, they exchange a lot, and so you see, okay, if you have a lot of people who have all contact, maybe not are all in contact, but nearly all, you say, this is a community of people, they exchange a lot, and you can detect this automatically. And there is a second concept which is very important, which is the concept of centrality. It means that, yes, you have a node which has contact with many, many other nodes. For instance, for some person in graphs, a leader who have contact with many, many, many people. And we have also visualization tool. So now I will show you how we represent the reuse with graph. So the first thing, yes, the elements are going to give some segment of text. So here, for instance, you have the first reusers here. You have T1 in relation with T2, which is the first reuse. I call it R1, okay? And you have a second. It's interesting because it's nearly the same text, but not exactly. Because, so you see, the beginning of the text, the first word is in Latin, the first word is not present in the second. And here, you see the text is nearly the same, but you have a small difference. For instance, you have et cb, cb, et. And the third one is this one. But you see, it's the same passage on the text, the same place. So we consider that this is one node. And the first step of our algorithm is to be able to detect this node and then to detect all the relation with other node in the huge databases of 800,000 of reusers. And then we use some graph theory concept. The first is what people call connex components. Very simple is the fact that you have components of the graph where nodes are related to each other. There is a path between nodes, but no path between the other node. Here is, this is an example. You have three connex components. You see, you don't have relation between the first and the second, between the second and the first and the third. Okay? So this is the first thing which is quite easy to detect. But the second thing which is interesting is this notion of community. So I call it cluster. I don't know. We had discussion because we disagree with the name. But it's not a problem. The notion is crucial. The idea is that sometimes you have a relation between part of the graph, but this relation are not very important and not very dense. So you can say, OK, I can ignore this relation. And this is what we are doing. So the first thing is, I am able to cluster all those reusers. But the question is how to interrogate this cluster, how to query them. So we develop a small language, which is, I just presented here. We say, you need to know who are the author of the node, because this corresponds to some piece of text. You need to know, for instance, what is the minimal length of reused text, what is the date. Maybe it is interesting to have some idea about the words which are present in the title of the text, or maybe you may have other metadata, for instance, the birth of the author is very important because sometimes you want to know what is the reuse, so you start from Rousseau and you want to just, you need to know that the author birth is in the 19th century, so you are sure it's reuse. So these are some examples of queries here. And then, so we have, for instance, this is a query, and we have a request here, and we get a lot of connex component here. And then I will show how you can visualize this connect. So here are different connect components. Sometimes you have a lot, sometimes you have only a few connected component. And here, I just give you an example. Now, the question of visualization. So we use different techniques. The first technique we're using is a software which was developed initially in my lab, but now it has been developed in University Compiègne and in Sciences Po Paris, but there are many people in the world who use it. This is a Gephi visualization tool. But I'm using also other visualization tools, which for practical purpose are far more interesting because you can visualize just on a browser, web browser, which is very easy. But I don't want to go in depth in the detail. So here you have, for instance, a request which corresponds to Dolbach, and you get this graph, which is interesting because you see here. You can see, but here the name is Dolbach here, and you have a lot of author here. And here you have D'Alembert here, and it's very interesting. And what is interesting is that when you look it, you see you have some nodes which are more central. For instance, here Dolbach is, oh, you don't see, I'm sorry, you don't see the link, but Dolbach is reused by many people. And so it is interesting to characterize this kind of thing. And this is what we do with the notion of centrality. What is a node which is very central? So this is a question in graph theory, and we have not one answer. But usually you say, okay, the notion of centrality may be related to the notion of degree. You know, the degree of a node in a graph is number of edges which start from this node. But you may have other definition of degree of centrality. For instance, the average distance with other nodes is minimal. Say, yeah, etc., and etc. You have different, but we can try and test this different notion. What is important in the visualization tool is that you color the node according to the centrality, which is, okay, you see here, the two very central nodes are Dolbach here and D'Alembert here, and it's very interesting then to see, okay, what is really. So this is what we are doing there, and this is another example. So we are able then to go back to the Chicago website and to see exactly what are the pieces of text, and we may also have the pieces of text here on the on this page. So I give you some example here, and sometimes, so these are galaxies, these are connect components, but sometimes you have some connected components which are very big. And as Robert mentioned before, one of these galaxies was related to the jurisprudence. You have many galaxies, but one, and you see, it's very big. It's so big that you cannot see anything here. So it's difficult. Then what is interesting is to use the community detection software. And so we are using a classical algorithm which was developed in my lab a long time ago, and it's called Louvain algorithm. Maybe some of you have heard about this algorithm. And then you are able to see, okay, these nodes are connected together, but they have a lot of connection. So here, this is a small cluster from this galaxy, which is very big. And here, this is a small cluster. Here, I added the name of the author, but okay, we can go if you go on the Acer on Gephi or on other graph visualization tool, we can go more in depth. So this is just to give you a test of this kind of thing. And now I will give you an example. We test it on Rousseau, on Frontex and TGB. And then we start with different query. And first, Rousseau, you have a lot of galaxy, and then Rousseau and the contrat social, and then Rousseau literature, you have a lot of galaxy, and this is, for instance, I took, this is one example, this 31,234, this is this example which I show you here, so it is interesting, you see Rousseau, and you see here, this is a quotation of Fontenelle by Rousseau, which is interesting. It's not Rousseau which was reused, but Rousseau will reuse as an author. But there is a strange thing here. You see Rousseau and politics, and you have nothing. So that what does it mean? It's strange. And it's funny, because when I present this first preliminary results in Chicago, there was a French philosopher, I don't remember his name, is it one of your friends? So she said, oh, why you don't have politics? I know when I went to the TGB, I know there are a lot of Rousseau texts which are characterized in the politics session with politic keyword. And the reason is very interesting, is that in fact, what I didn't say before, you have a lot of connect component, and there are more or less big, and, but there is one huge connected component, which contain here more than 400,000 nodes, which was really a lot. And then I didn't want to explore this, so then I use a community detection. And it was very interesting because I was able to do so. This is just so here I extracted the cluster, and then so this philosopher told me, I'm sure there are some reference to Rousseau in the French National Library, especially there are quotations from Proudhon who quotes Rousseau. So I explore this, and for instance, I try, so here, to detect the cluster which contain Rousseau and Proudhon. And I got this cluster. And you see, it's very difficult to explore because you have a lot of node here, and it seems that you have a very central node here. So here, I show you the central node, and I show you more in depth. Yeah, this is Rousseau, which is in the central node. And here, I just, I didn't say, but you don't see here, in this is Montesquieu. And I think, okay. So you may quote, you may query these databases of cluster using the degree of the node and the name of the node, which is very interesting because, okay, if it is very central, you can imagine that it is quoted by as a node. And then, okay, you can go, this is Rousseau. And then, okay, you have a lot of nodes. So if you want to know if there is, for instance, some quotation of Rousseau by Proudhon, so then you need to filter. And you have a second, so you can use the same query, and you can filter and say, okay, I want just, in this graph, the link between Rousseau and Proudhon. And fortunately, I just got one here. It was Proudhon in the oeuvre complète who quote le discours sur les sur l'origine et fondement de l'inégalité parmi les hommes. And then here is another example, another cluster, always with Proudhon and Rousseau. It's a huge cluster. So I don't remember the number of nodes, but it's huge. And here, when you go inside the cluster, you see this is Rousseau, which is quoted. And now, if you are looking here, Rousseau and Proudhon, you have this quotation of L'Émile ou l'Éducation. And here, yes, you can see this is L'Émile et l'Éducation. And when I discuss with Robert, he told me, yes, it's normal because it's the text of Rousseau, which is good. Just what I want to show you here is that it's a way to explore big database of reusers, and I think it can be very useful for humanists in the future. And in the future, what I want is to continue the development of these tools, but not only, and I agree with Clovis, not only with this detection of reuse using n-gram, but also with other technique, and I developed a semantic search engine, which take just concept and concept which are very close to each other, and this is what I would like to do on very big databases. Thank you.
Inspector and Jean Gabriel is around this question of when he kept back, he finds one passage that's actually quoted, but it's like Robespierre, we know he's saturated with Rousseau, and you want to be able to try to locate similar passages. So just a comment on that particular thing.
Are there any questions? Do you have questions you'd like to raise or anything you'd like to discuss?
So I think what we have to do now is you have to.
Oh, okay.
This is one of these things.
A very quick question on the graph. It's a very simple one. So each of the nodes are texts, and the edges are instances of reuse, and the weight on the edge is some aggregation over the reuse. Or is each of the nodes an author, and each of the edges then instances of reuse in some way?
No. No, the nodes are text, in fact. Yes, but to visualize and to understand, if you show the text, very, very difficult. So to simplify, I just show here the name of the author and sometimes the title. But in fact, these are... yes, it's talks, yeah. Chunk of text, chunk, yeah. To another text, yeah. Yeah. This is exactly, so this is, yeah. No, there is no way. The only things we can do is maybe to consider the size of the reuses or the proximity, and then you can weight according to these different. No, it's not direction, but you can if you want. Sure. So it's a question, because. So it's not always easy to know exactly what is the date, because you have sometime this correspond to the edition of the book, and so you have the author, but sometimes you know what is the birth date and of the author, but not always. So this is the reason why. In the first step, we just decided not to orient the graph. But
this is a big problem.
This is
this size, you're not exactly. It took us a long time before we even figured out what was in. Then trying to figure out what are duplicates, what are real duplicates. There are just all kinds of sort of basic. Questions that you're constantly going back over, try to figure out how to anchor a text to know when there is a reuse over time, what's the point of departure, becomes a problem when you're dealing with, several hundred thousand texts that are just drawn, that are just published works of a given century.
Okay, thanks.
Well, so the results, in some sense, in some sense, I think, and Glenn, you might want to chime in on this, but so basically, the kinds of results we're able to get now are the kinds of things we just gave you. That is to say, when we're trying to look at how the encyclopedia was read in the 19th century, well, we know it's not read like we read it now. We know that the articles we consider as seminal are not the ones that are read or not the ones that are cited. So it gives you insight, at least on some level, as to how these texts are read and what is important for the 19th century in relationship to what is important for us now. So in that sense, you're really able to get a very different idea of how the text is read over time. And then you're able to do things that are extraordinarily useful, like just getting into Gallica. I don't know if you've worked with Gallica much, but just trying to, it's a big database. So this gives you things that are not, so many of the things that most of us do are, I want to know, I have this passage of Rousseau, I want to know when it's reused. But this kind of work allows you to just take two big databases, like it could be the Frontext and the TGB, or it can be the Encyclopédie, and just say, what is reused? You're not even trying to say, I want to find such and such. And so that gives you a very different perspective on who is cited, who is reused. One example being, for example, that if you look at when the Encyclopédie is cited, you might talk about Voltaire for a moment. Just when the Encyclopédie is cited in the 19th century, Voltaire is rarely it comes up.
Sure, I mean that's as I alluded to earlier. That's because Voltaire is more or less the sort of clearinghouse of older texts. That's this function in the Encyclopédie. But if you then take his text, his proper text, from Frontext, and you compare him to the, he's preponderant. I mean, he's everywhere. So Voltaire is this huge figure, much more so than Rousseau, much more so than Diderot has a very weird relationship with the 19th century because they didn't quite know him, who he was yet. It's a late 19th century invention, our conception of Diderot. So Diderot's doesn't really exist, his works. Rousseau in the social contract political philosophy realm is quite prevalent, as is Émile, but the Confession less so. But Voltaire is everywhere.
So weirdly enough, Rousseau, when he's cited, he's often cited like in grammar books, books on grammar, like because he has a specific construct, and they're going to reuse Rousseau's social contracts to give an example on how this construct functions. And so he's not necessarily reused the way we would think.
I think
we would expect.
Just to get back to your about analysis, that's the big question. I mean, there's a huge amount of data, and you go in with a huge amount of data, and you end up with more. I mean, we had this problem with the Echo collection, where we went in with this huge data set, and we came out with 38 million alignments. So we had more data than we had more to do. And so it goes back to how can we winnow this down? How can we attack it? And it comes down to this idea of you're constantly trying to think of heuristic ways of moving inside of this. So take one text, see how it sort of resonates out. Take one author, take one. And I think we're trying to allow that so any users can combine this sort of heuristic tools into a way of diving into this data, which is really huge.
This doesn't give interpretation, but I think this allow you to test different interpretation. And what you can do is that I see the first you have a query, so you are looking for a connect component or community which answer your query, and then you use filter. And for instance, you can say, okay, I want, for instance, this text of Rousseau with a high degree. And also, here I didn't say that the length, the diameter of the node corresponds to the length of the text, which is important also. And you can also say, okay, I want just to I eliminate that text with other author which date birth is before Rousseau, and then so you can clean this connected component and try to test different hypotheses. And this is exactly so what we want to do in the future is to build a tool which can be easy to use by many people, and that people can appropriate very easily to test different hypotheses.
Well, we have, and our problem was scale. It's always been scale. I remember talking to Marco Büchler about it maybe 2 years ago, and at the time he was certainly very interested in what we were doing, and he suggested that we try to fold in what we were doing into Tracer. Unfortunately, we were well on the way on our project, so we weren't able to combine forces, essentially. So this didn't happen. The other thing is that we already had a working software, Philolene, which was built 10 years ago. So we had a clear model of what to do, and we knew that it worked, so we just needed to improve on it, on the algorithm, on the way it was designed, and on the way it was running, to accomplish what we were setting, what we were looking for. So, we have run it, so what we took is the Dictionnaire de Littré, which is a 19th century dictionary, which cites all of its examples are cited from classical sources of French, literature. And so what we did is we tried to find whether we were able to find all of them, and we had a very high level of accuracy and very little recall. So yes, we did run it. We did not try to run it. We did try to run it with Phoebus, which was Jean-Gabriel's software, and we had similar results, in fact. So that's the reason why we didn't f-
feel the need to go and look elsewhere, essentially. So when we did run these comparisons, we ran it with what we had at the time, which was Philolene and Phibius. And so basically, we built this new piece of software based on Phibius and what Philolene did. So
ETrap won't scale.
And ETrap, yeah, from what we know, ETrap will not scale to that level. There's also another R package called Text Reuse, which also does not scale at all. I know we've tried it, and so in our case, it's a problem of scale. So running on 100,000 texts or more.
This is the point. This is where you move up to this number. None of the software that we looked at is able to go to that level.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So let's. I'm sorry, we're going to have to move on. Please talk directly to the speakers. Thank you so much. This is fabulous. We're going to pick up some related themes in the next session. Why don't we take a 5-minute break?